Good evening. This is Reverend Bookburn. The show is called The Reverend Is In, and tonight the theme is 9/11, 2 years later, nation still clueless. And going to start off with a track by a band that was very short-lived called Los Gusanos, and they're on Alternative Tentacles, and this included at least one member of the Ramones. And it's actually an early 70s song that was originally called I'd Love to Change the World. However, this had more updated lyrics and is entitled I'd Love to Save the World. Los Gusanos. Hey.
Got lucky with a strike. Drilling for fear makes the job simple. Born on third, thinks he got a triple. Of suffering and the odd negotiation of rarity with onion skin plausibility of life and a keyboard reaffirmation.
The world. Who wants to shoot the girl? Who gets to work for bread? Who wants to get ahead? Who hands out equal rights? Who starts and ends that fight? Not rant and rave or end up a slave. Who can make hard-won games fall like summer rain? Every man must be what his life can be. So don't call me a chump, I will walk away. Who wants to please everyone? Who says it all can be done? You'll sit up on that fence. No one I've heard of yet. Don't call me baby. Don't talk in maybe. Don't talk like has been. Sing it like it should be. Nagging down. La to touch someone. Hey, I want to be so don't call me. Should I will walk away? Call me. Should I will walk away?
the background, you are hearing Mad World by Corrosion of Conformity. Before that, Corrosion of Conformity, Lost for Words. DOA did America the Beautiful. Midnight Oil did One Country. Pearl Jam did Bush Ligger. And started off with Los Gusanos doing I'd Love to Save the World. This is Reverend Book Byrne. The show is called The Reverend is In. It's on every Sunday night live at RadioVolta.org and relay broadcast live at AtheistNetwork.com. And at the latter, you can hear the show repeat broadcasted Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays in the mornings and evenings, as well as, oh so appropriately, Sunday morning, where the show is back-to-back with the Hour of Slack. And apologies for all the screw-ups for the repeat broadcasts in this past week. Reportedly, the problems have been remedied. And thank you, people who remedied the problems. As well as relay broadcasted on two independent radio stations in the state of Washington, one in Olympia and one in Seattle. The Reverend is available for weddings of couples or groups of any orientation or lifestyle, including those from the transgendered or kink communities outside or across the street from Catholic fundamentalist or any other Taliban-modeled theocratic church. If you want to write to me, write Rev. Book Byrne, care of Quail, as in Dan Quayle, Q-U-A-Y-L-E, Quayle at sjcdc.org. And at that website, sjcdc.org, South Jersey Clinic Defense Coalition, you can check out an article entitled Theocracy and Sexual Freedom. Next week on The Reverend is In, Cooking with Paul Hill. And that will be a party show, and you can also dance during the show, I guess around your computer. And on September 28th, in 2 weeks, hopefully this will happen, live guest Diane Fornbacher from Drug Policy Forum Tri-State and her female comedian friend. And after that, I don't know. Tonight's theme is September 11th, 2 years later, Nation Still Clueless. And I'm going to let some spoken word recordings and speeches that I think more of the nation should have had access to and should have been able to hear on that anniversary, that will be played, and that will do a lot of the speaking on tonight's theme for me, and I want to keep it down to what I think was left out of those tracks and play them. They're a bit long, so we'll also have some great tunes to kind of balance it out. A big thank you to everybody who provided feedback for the last two shows, parts one and two of Strap-On Cruise Missiles. And your words, your jokes, and your information and informative emails are most appreciated. And we'll kind of touch on those subjects a little bit again tonight, if time permits. But I realize that in doing themes like that and exercises like that and trying to heal the sickest people on the planet, namely those who govern us and make war and kill thousands of civilians for oil interests, are probably the hardest people to help to heal and cure. But as a clergy person, the Reverend has to believe that there is some trace of humanity even within these people, and that was why we attempted those themes. So yeah, we'll touch on them lightly if time permits. And a handful of other things. I'm trying to keep the talking down and get to these great tracks that I think just say it all. And speaking of Strap-On Cruise Missiles, the primary Strap-On from the White House, George W. Bush, will be in this area tomorrow, June 15th. Bush will be in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, at a place called Drexel Brook Banquet Facility. And that is at Drexel Brook Drive in Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania, from 5 to 7 p.m. And several anti-war groups and peace and justice groups will be protesting there. They are meeting at the Drexel Brook Shopping Center at Wildell and Revere Roads at 5 o'clock. Information available from telephone 610-544-1818 or 610-891-6614. And there's directions thanks to the place that's hosting George W. Numbnuts Bush, the Drexel Brook Catering, which is at drexelbrookcatering.com/directions.htm. And that will be, of course, a nonviolent protest against the war criminal as he comes to Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania. And let's see what's coming up. Well, of course, the clinic frontline news is that in the wake of renewed terroristic threats that have been ignored by pretty much all law enforcement, federal, state, local, the fatherland security buffoons, all the way down the line, there was barely an improvement the second week after their post-execution of Paul Hill threats and declarations of holy war and punishing the nation and avenging Paul Hill's death, etc. The clinics have had a slight improvement in this region and maybe a 5% improvement nationwide. So it's still something that is not taken seriously. A form of terrorism that is viewed as something that is ignorable. And this is something we're going to address in detail on next week's show, Cooking with Paul Hill. The terrorism by white Christians, whose rhetoric is identical to Al-Qaeda's, and since these people have been bombing clinics and shooting people for over 20 years and came first, they actually serve as the role models for Al-Qaeda and Taliban types of groups. And we'll dedicate next week's show to every doctor, staff person, clinic defender, and innocent bystander who has fallen to terrorism that has been ignored and not taken seriously by those who are supposedly anti-terrorism. Let's see. Well, the speeches on the anniversary of September 11th were predictable. I noticed that there's an equal amount of usage of all the buzzwords like we and our enemy is wounded but resourceful, and kind of still pushing this illusion that there's a kind of oneness that includes the government and corporate America and the people whom government represents, the oil interests and the corporate leaders and the common person. And so that in and of itself made the rhetorical speeches total bullshit, as well as the complete lack of acknowledgement of white supremacist terrorists and anti-abortion terrorists. So the propaganda, the corporate media, compliance with the Bush regime's propaganda machine, and the events themselves were totally as we predicted it. They showed once again the absolute need, the absolute importance of supporting independent media and doing shows that are not controlled by the likes of Clear Channel and Infinity and other such goonery, and providing independent news as well as entertainment, and including this show with its diverse content, and providing what is lacking in popular news and entertainment mediums. So this will continue for as long as possible. They are going after it, so do not tolerate efforts to silence independent media. They're going after it not just through overt censorship and repressive legislation, but also through the anti-Napster and anti-downloading proposed laws that would include independent broadcasters by saying you would owe a royalty rate per song per listener, which would be a disaster for this show. It would be like hearing your rent just became $100,000 a month and tomorrow's lunch will be $10,000. It's not just insane and unjustified, but it's also impossible and would put everybody but the vanilla entertainers and propagandistic corporate media propagandists as the sole voices of this nation. Okay, already sick of talking. So we'll come back and play some music, talk when I come back again. Let's see, we plugged the Bush Action tomorrow. And just contact me if you need that information again. And write to me if you want the notoriously long playlist, which includes the songs played this evening as well as everything discussed, the web links for those things plugged and promoted, etc. Or to give feedback or your ideas for the forthcoming shows. Alright, what else? Oh, one website you can go to while you're perusing the web and listening to the tracks that are coming up. Bushrecall.org is a necessary site that I'd like to see continue. And there's also some September 11th information sites that I wrote down for a great article by Laura Rosen called Terror's Discontent. That's at Tom Paine, TomPaine.com. All kinds of unanswered questions about September 11th and that official commission report at unanswered questions.org. Why don't we have answers to these September 11th questions? And September 11th family members pursue true peace from truthout.org. And we're going to hear two spoken word releases, a couple of tracks from each. One a little later in the show. The one we're about to hear after a song is by a woman from India named Arunhati Roy. This is a CD that just came out from AlternativeTentacles.com, and it's entitled Come September, In Conversation with Howard Zinn. And she talks about war, the corporate media, nationalism, government policies, and government propaganda like you are anti-nationalism or you are anti-American. And although I have my own agreements and disagreements with both of the spoken word tracks, I thought they were excellent releases, and I'm very impressed with Arunhati Roy, her books, and this new CD, and thought this would be a good alternative voice to the bullshit speeches that have been saturating the corporate media for the last couple of days, actually all week. And but this will be a refreshing alternative intellectually stimulating, understandable to anybody, including Joe and Joanne, bar buddy, and coffee shop fellow conversationalist. So we're going to play Aaron Hunty Roy, but first let's rock out with a band called The Jags. This song is Back of My Hand. I've got your number. Play. Lord, make this machine work.
You're only coming if you're feeling blue. You tell me I don't pay attention to you. But if you only knew just what I'm going through, you wouldn't phone those guys who make me alone with you. Oh, when I call you, I can sacrifice. You would the map of who you try you at. I'm not a professional, an 1860s dream. I can bet you this thing, but you didn't see her. You're not unreadable, you're not unreadable. I know just what you are, don't push your love too far. You're not untouchable, not just another girl. I get in touch with you, I only wish I knew that. I got your number, written on the back of my head. I got your number, written on the back of my head. I got your number, written on the back of my head. I got your number. I had a dream, I met another girl. But in my mind, she was just kicking sad. I hope I'm getting through the interference too. My money's running out, I don't know how to say now. The operator's saying cut the land. You wanna cut it by the very last time. You're only young at heart. You start just realizing when I get down here. You're not unreadable, you're not unbeatable. I know just what you are, don't push your love too far. You're not untouchable, not just another girl. I get in touch with you, I only wish you knew that. I got your number, written down the back of my head. I got your number, written down the back of my head. Your number, who didn't have the back of my head. I got your number. Say, where's your number, guys? You only call me if you're feeling blue. You tell me I don't pay attention to you. But if you wanna know just where I'm going through, you wouldn't phone those guys from Michelin, would you, girl? You're not unreadable, you're not unreadable. I know just what you are, don't push your luck too far. You're not untouchable, not just another girl. I get in touch with you, I only wish you knew.
Writers imagine that they cull stories from the world. I'm beginning to believe that vanity makes them think so. That it's actually the other way around. Stories cull writers from the world. Stories reveal themselves to us, the public narrative, the private narrative. They colonize us, they commission us, they insist on being told. Fiction and non-fiction are only different techniques of storytelling. For reasons that I don't fully understand, fiction dances out of me, and non-fiction is wrenched out by the aching, broken world I wake up to every morning. The theme of much of what I write, fiction as well as non-fiction, is the relationship between power and powerlessness, and the endless circular conflict they're engaged in. John Berger, that most wonderful writer, once wrote, Never again will a single story be told as though it's the only one. There can never be a single story. There are only ways of seeing. So when I tell a story, I tell it not as an ideologue who wants to pit one absolutist ideology against another, but as a storyteller who wants to share her way of seeing. Though it might appear otherwise, my writing is not really about nations and histories. It's about power, about the paranoia and ruthlessness of power, about the physics of power. I believe that the accumulation of vast, unfettered power by a state or a country, a corporation or an institution, or even an individual, a spouse, a friend, a sibling, regardless of ideology, results in excesses such as the ones I will recount here. Living as I do, as millions of us do, in the shadow of the nuclear holocaust that the governments of India and Pakistan keep promising their brainwashed citizenry, and in the global neighborhood of the war against terror, what President Bush rather biblically calls the task that never ends, I find myself thinking a great deal about the relationship between citizens and the state. In India, those of us who have expressed views on nuclear bombs, big dams, corporate globalization, and the rising threat of communal Hindu fascism, views that are at variance with the Indian governments, are branded anti-national. While this accusation doesn't fill me with indignation, it's not an accurate description of what I do or how I think. Because an anti-national is a person who is against his or her own nation and by inference is pro some other one. But it isn't necessary to be anti-national to be deeply suspicious of all nationalism, to be anti-nationalism. Nationalism of one kind or another was the cause of most of the genocide of the 20th century. Flags are bits of colored cloth that governments use first to shrink wrap people's brains and then as ceremonial shrouds to bury the dead. When independent thinking people, and here I do not include the corporate media, begin to rally under flags, when writers, painters, musicians, filmmakers suspend their judgment and blindly yoke their art to the service of the nation, it's time for all of us to sit up and worry. In India, we saw it happen soon after the nuclear tests in 1998 and during the Kargil war against Pakistan in 1999. In the US, we saw it during the Gulf War, and we see it now during the war against terror, that blizzard of made-in-China American flags. Recently, those who have criticized the actions of the US government, myself included, have been called anti-American. Anti-Americanism is in the process of being consecrated into an ideology. The term anti-American is usually used by the American establishment to discredit and not falsely, but shall we say inaccurately, define its critics. Once someone is branded anti-American, the chances are that he or she will be judged before they are heard, and the argument will be lost in the welter of bruised national pride. But what does the term anti-American mean? Does it mean you're anti-jazz, or that you're opposed to free speech, that you don't delight in Toni Morrison or John Updike, that you have a quarrel with giant sequoias? Does it mean that you don't admire the hundreds of thousands of American citizens who marched against nuclear weapons, or the thousands of war resistors who forced their government to withdraw from Vietnam? Does it mean that you hate all Americans? This sly conflation of America's culture, music, literature, the breathtaking physical beauty of the land, the ordinary pleasures of ordinary people, with criticism of the US government's foreign policy, about which, thanks to America's free press, sadly most Americans know very little, is a deliberate and extremely effective strategy. It's like a retreating army taking cover in a heavily populated city, hoping that the prospect of hitting civilian targets will deter enemy fire. But there are many Americans who would be mortified to be associated with their government's policies. the most scholarly, scathing, incisive, hilarious critiques of the hypocrisy and the contradictions in U.S. government policy come from American citizens. When the rest of the world wants to know what the U.S. government is up to, we turn to Noam Chomsky, Edward Said, Howard Zinn, Ed Herman, Amy Goodman, Michael Albert, Chalmers Johnson, William Bloom, and Anthony Arnov to tell us what's really going on. Similarly, in India, not hundreds but millions of us would be ashamed and offended if we were in any way implicated with the present Indian government's fascist policies, which, apart from the perpetration of state terrorism in the Valley of Kashmir in the name of fighting terrorism, have also turned a blind eye to the recent state-supervised pogrom against Muslims in Gujarat. Last year, like many others, I too made the mistake of scoffing at this post-September 11 rhetoric, dismissing it as foolish and arrogant. But I realized that it's not foolish at all. It's actually a canny recruitment drive for a misconceived, dangerous war. Every day I'm taken aback at how many people believe that opposing the war in Afghanistan amounts to supporting terrorism or voting for the Taliban. Now that the initial aim of the war, capturing Osama bin Laden, dead or alive, seems to have run into bad weather, the goalposts have been moved. It's being made out the whole point of the war was to topple the Taliban regime and liberate Afghan women from their burqas. We are being asked to believe that the U.S. Marines are actually on a feminist mission. If so, will their next stop be America's military ally, Saudi Arabia? Think of it this way. In India, there are some pretty reprehensible social practices against untouchables, against Christians and Muslims, against women. Pakistan and Bangladesh have even worse ways of dealing with minority communities and women. Should they be bombed? Should Delhi, Islamabad, and Dhaka be destroyed? Is it possible to bomb bigotry out of India? Can we bomb our way to a feminist paradise? Is that how women won the vote in the U.S.? Or how slavery was abolished? Can we win redress for the genocide of the millions of Native Americans upon whose corpses the United States was founded by bombing Santa Fe? None of us need anniversaries to remind us of what we cannot forget. So it's no more than coincidence that I happen to be here on American soil in September, this month of dreadful anniversaries. Uppermost on everybody's mind, of course, particularly here in America, is the horror of what has come to be known as 9/11. Nearly 3,000 civilians lost their lives in that lethal terrorist strike. The grief is still deep, the rage still sharp. The tears have not dried, and a strange, deadly war is raging round the world. Yet each person who has lost a loved one surely knows, secretly, deeply, that no war, no act of revenge, no daisy cutters dropped on someone else's loved ones or someone else's children will blunt the edges of their pain or bring their own loved ones back. War cannot avenge those who have died. War is only a brutal desecration of their memory. To fuel yet another war, this time against Iraq, by cynically manipulating people's grief, by packaging it for TV specials, sponsored by corporations selling detergent and running shoes, is to cheapen and devalue grief, to drain it of meaning. What we are seeing now is a vulgar display of the business of grief, the commerce of grief, the pillaging of even the most private human feelings for political purpose. It is a terrible, violent thing for a state to do to its people. It's not a clever enough subject to speak of from a public platform, but what I would really love to talk to you about is loss. Loss and losing. Grief, failure, brokenness, numbness, uncertainty, fear, the death of feeling, the death of dreaming, the absolute, relentless, endless, habitual unfairness of the world. What does loss mean to individuals? What does it mean to whole cultures, whole people who have learned to live with it as a constant companion? Since it is September 11th we're talking about, perhaps it's in the fitness of things that we remember what that date means, not only to those who lost their loved ones in America last year, but to those in other parts of the world to whom that date has long held significance. This historical dredging is not offered as an accusation or a provocation, but just to share the grief of history, to thin the mist a little, to say to the citizens of America in the gentlest, most human way, welcome to the world. 29 years ago, in Chile, on the 11th of September, 1973, General Pinochet overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in a CIA-backed coup. Chile should not be allowed to go Marxist just because its people are irresponsible, said Henry Kissinger, Nobel Peace Laureate, then the U.S. Secretary of State. After the coup, President Allende was found dead inside the presidential palace. Whether he was killed or whether he killed himself, we'll never know. In the regime of terror that ensued, thousands of people were killed. Many more simply disappeared. Firing squads conducted public executions. Concentration camps and torture chambers were opened across the country. The dead were buried in mine shafts and unmarked graves. For 17 years, the people of Chile lived in dread of the midnight knock, of routine disappearances, of sudden arrest and torture. Chileans tell the story of how the musician Victor Jara had his hands cut off in front of a crowd in the Santiago Stadium. Before they shot him, Pinochet's soldiers threw his guitar at him and mockingly asked him to play. In 1999, following the arrest of General Pinochet in Britain, thousands of secret documents were declassified by the U.S. government. They contain unequivocal evidence of the CIA's involvement in the coup, as well as the fact that the U.S. government had detailed information about the situation in Chile during General Pinochet's reign. Yet, Kissinger assured the general of his support. In the United States, as you know, we are sympathetic to what you're trying to do, he said. We wish your government well. Those of us who have only ever known life in a democracy, however flawed, would find it hard to imagine what living in a dictatorship and enduring the absolute loss of freedom means. It isn't just those who Pinochet murdered, but the lives he stole from the living that must be accounted for too. Sadly, Chile was not the only country in South America to be singled out for the U.S. government's attentions. Guatemala, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Brazil, Peru, the Dominican Republic, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Honduras, Panama, El Salvador, Peru, Mexico, and Colombia. They've all been the playground for covert and overt operations by the CIA. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been killed, tortured, or have simply disappeared under the despotic regimes that were propped up in their countries. If this were not humiliation enough, the people of South America have had to bear the cross of being branded as people who are incapable of democracy, as if coups and massacres are somehow encrypted in their genes. This list does not, of course, include countries in Africa or Asia that suffered U.S. military interventions: Vietnam, Korea, Indonesia, Laos, and Cambodia. For how many Septembers, for decades together, have millions of Asian people been bombed and burned and slaughtered? How many Septembers have gone by since August 1945, when hundreds of thousands of ordinary Japanese people were obliterated by the nuclear strikes in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? For how many Septembers have the thousands who had the misfortune of surviving those strikes endured the living hell that was visited on them, their unborn children, their children's children? On the earth, the sky, the water, the wind, and all the creatures that swim and walk and crawl and fly. Not far from here in Albuquerque, is the National Atomic Museum, where Fat Man and Little Boy, the affectionate nicknames for bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were available as souvenir earrings. Funky young people wore them, a massacre dangling in each ear. But I'm straying from my theme. It's September that we're talking about, not August. September 11th has a tragic resonance in the Middle East too. On the 11th of September, 1922, ignoring Arab outrage, the British government proclaimed a mandate in Palestine, a follow-up to the 1917 Balfour Declaration, which Imperial Britain issued with its army massed outside the gates of Gaza. The Balfour Declaration promised European Zionists a national home for Jewish people. At the time, the empire on which the sun never set was free to snatch and bequeath national homes like a school bully distributes marbles. How carelessly imperial power vivisected ancient civilizations. Palestine and Kashmir are Imperial Britain's festering, blood-drenched gifts to the modern world. Both are fault lines in the raging international conflicts of today. In 1937, Winston Churchill said of the Palestinians, I quote, "I do not agree that the dog in a manger has the final right to the manger, even though he may have lain there for a very long time. I do not admit that right. I do not admit, for instance, that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race, to put it that way, has come in and taken their place." That set the trend for the Israeli state's attitude towards Palestinians. In 1969, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir said, "Palestinians do not exist." Her successor, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, said, "What are Palestinians? When I came here to Palestine, there were 250,000 non-Jews, mainly Arabs and Bedouins. It was a desert, more than underdeveloped, nothing." Prime Minister Menachem Begin calls Palestinians two-legged beasts. Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir called them grasshoppers who could be crushed. This is the language of heads of state, not the words of ordinary people. In 1947, the UN formally partitioned Palestine and allotted 55% of Palestine's land to the Zionists. Within a year, they had captured 76%. On the 14th of May, 1948, the State of Israel was declared. Minutes after the declaration, the United States recognized Israel. The West Bank was annexed by Jordan. The Gaza Strip came under Egyptian military control. And formally, Palestine ceased to exist except in the minds and hearts of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people who became refugees. In 1967, Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Over the decades, there have been uprisings, wars, intifadas. Tens of thousands have lost their lives. Accords and treaties have been signed, ceasefires declared and violated. But the bloodshed doesn't end. Palestine still remains illegally occupied. Its people live in inhuman conditions, in virtual Bantustans, where they are subjected to collective punishments, 24-hour curfews, where they are humiliated and brutalized on a daily basis. They never know when their homes will be demolished, when their children will be shot, when their precious trees will be cut, when their roads will be closed, when they will be allowed to walk down to the market to buy food and medicine, and when they will not. They live with no semblance of dignity, with not much hope in sight. They have no control over their lands, their security, their movement, their communication, their water supply. So when accords are signed and words like autonomy and even statehood bandied about, it's always worth asking, what sort of autonomy, what sort of state, what sort of rights will its citizens have? Young Palestinians who cannot control their anger turn themselves into human bombs and haunt Israel's streets and public places, blowing themselves up, killing ordinary people, injecting terror into daily life, and eventually hardening both societies' suspicion and mutual hatred of each other. Each bombing invites merciless reprisal and even more hardship on Palestinian people. But then, suicide bombing is an act of individual despair, not a revolutionary tactic. Although Palestinian attacks strike terror into Israeli citizens, they provide the perfect cover for the Israeli government's daily incursions into Palestinian territory, the perfect excuse for old-fashioned 19th century colonialism dressed up as a new-fashioned 20th century war. Israel's staunchest political and military ally is, and always has been, the U.S. The U.S. government has blocked, along with Israel, almost every U.N. resolution that sought a peaceful, equitable solution to the conflict. It has supported almost every war that Israel has fought. When Israel attacks Palestine, it is American missiles that smash through Palestinian homes. And every year, Israel receives several billion dollars from the United States, taxpayers' money. What lessons should we draw from this tragic conflict? Is it really impossible for Jewish people who suffered so cruelly themselves, more cruelly perhaps than any other people in history, to understand the vulnerability and the yearning of those whom they have displaced? Does extreme suffering always kindle cruelty? What hope does this leave the human race with? What will happen to the Palestinian people in the event of a victory? When a nation without a state eventually proclaims a state, what kind of state will it be? What horrors will be perpetrated under its flag? Is it a separate state that we should be fighting for, or the rights to a life of liberty and dignity for everyone, regardless of their ethnicity or religion? Palestine was once a secular bulwark in the Middle East, but now the weak, undemocratic, by all accounts corrupt but avowedly non-sectarian PLO is losing ground to Hamas, which espouses an overtly sectarian ideology and fights in the name of Islam. To quote from their manifesto, "We will be its soldiers and the firewood of its fire, which will burn the enemies." The world is called upon to condemn suicide bombers, but can we ignore the long road they have journeyed on before they arrived at this destination? September 11, 1922 to September 11, 2002. 80 years is a long time to have been waging war. Is there some advice the world can give the people of Palestine? Should they just take Golda Meir's suggestion and make a real effort not to exist?
Days, holidays, vacation time, we must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover! That's the first thing to do. Duck and cover. First, you duck. And then, you cover. You duck and cover. Tight. Duck and cover under the table.
shukrati of sun, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai, ye jang to ek bahana hai. Dehshatgardi afsana hai.
A puppeteer's hand. Push it. Push it. The old president's son. Push it. That's the way it's done. Push it. For all of your friends, who knows where this whole thing's gonna end. Then someone goes and topples the towers. Took years to build, destroyed it in hours. The FBI and CIA said, give us more powers. Push it. Then the puppeteer says, hey, I got a plan. Though the guys were all Saudis, let's bomb Afghanistan and camp out with our friends in Pakistan. Push it. But that wasn't the end to these tragic attacks. Someone used the U.S. mail to send anthrax. Kinda funny how it just went to Democrats. Push it. Push it. The old president's boy. Push it. He got a brand new toy. Push it. Down old Texas way. Hey, now look at Georgie Jr. play. Vice President
President Cheney meets with Enron, of course, on how to manage our oil resource. Get them rolling blackouts and a secret task force. We'll push it. Then Enron goes bankrupt after stealing us blind, but they left a trail of campaign cash behind. When asked for his records, Cheney big time declined. He said, push it. Now before 9-1-1, Bush wasn't too bright. Did Osama bin Laden show him the light? They're both CIA boys and they know how to fight. They push it. Push it. To the limit and then push it. And push it again. Push it. And make no mistake, there is just so much that we can take. He's got two drunken daughters and a drug addict niece. But that doesn't matter. He'll just call up the police and say you can keep all the others, but I want their release. Push it. Now he did booze and coke, and he doesn't deny it, but he says that he quit and is on a new diet. Now he passes out on pretzels. Does anyone buy it? Push it. Now Bush is an artist, and he's trying to sell it. He's a bit of a devil, doesn't think we can tell it, but it's piled up so high, you can't help but smell it. Bush it. Bush it. The new president's song. Bush it. You know he can't be wrong. Bush it. Out of the president's way. What more can a real American say? Bush it. Bush it. Bush it. We'll be right back.
You heard Vic Bondi doing Fortunate Son, his old band Articles of Faith in the background. Daryl Cherney and the Chernobyls did Bush It. DJ Disorientalist did Occident and Emergency from the Peace Not War double CD benefit compilation. And that featured, of course, the old 50s nuclear propaganda phrase, duck and cover. From Aaron Hante Roy, the spoken word CD, you heard the following tracks: Suspicion of Nationalism, Commerce of Grief, and Many Septembers. And started off with the Jags, Back of My Hand, I've Got Your Number. This is Reverend Bookburn's show. It's called The Reverend Is In. Tonight's theme is September 11th, 2 years later, Nation Still Clueless. And this is, of course, taking more time than I anticipated. I see how much time has already been eaten up, and I do have another spoken word CD that I want to play from on this anniversary weekend. So, going to cut out a whole lot of material and just get back into it. I'm going to play a song before you hear Jim Hightower speak. This is from one or both of the Ben and Jerry's guys. They started what that $87 billion of new war money that President Numbnuts asked for his continued war and occupation, what that could be used for in terms of the needs of American people and the services that are needed, and as well as the upcoming action this October in Washington, D.C. This website is at truemajority.org. And from the mailbag, we have an Audrey Hepburn quote. Quote, people, even more than things, have to be restored, renewed, revived, reclaimed, and redeemed. Never throw out anyone. That's from Audrey Hepburn. Thank you, person who sent that to the Reverend. And another article about funding all these delusional abstinence programs and propaganda and Christian supremacy programs. It's by Suzanne Goldberg from England. And there's no web link, so you'll just have to ask for me to send this to you by email. No sex, please. You're American. The Bush administration is pouring millions of dollars into programs that persuade young people to hold on to their virginity. Articles on Cancun and the World Trade Organization gathering, as well as September 11th at alternet.org. And now all of Paul Krasner's books, or the ones still in print, as well as his CDs, are at his website, Paul Krasner, Paul K-R-A-S-S-N-E-R, paulkrasner.com. And his column is being published by the New York Press, but they're online for people who are not in New York, and that's at newyorkpress.com. His column is called The Zen Bastard. Okay, cute little coffee goddess story. While the Reverend was putting the finishing touches on today's show this morning, while getting the desperately needed coffee and listening to the coffee goddesses vent their frustrations, one said, I am stuck here forever. And she and the Reverend hashed it out for a really long time with the following idea that kind of went with the discussion that we were in, which was, if we're so conditioned for the negative, if we're so conditioned to focus on all that is hostile or upsetting in life, then you are setting yourself up for further disappointment and suffering, and more importantly, not making change. So what if you did the opposite? What if you visualized better and focused on vision, ideas, and action? So, to the coffee goddess and to anyone else who needs a message like this, visualize walking away, visualize making a positive life change, and visualize being free of whatever is weighing down on your mind. And thank you, coffee goddess, for, as always, providing radio material. The new editorial by Dr. Susan Block is one of the best yet. It's on the outrageous prosecution by the Justice Department and the Ashcroft crowd, who have nothing better to do. There's no real need to concern themselves with the American Christian terrorists. So why not just focus on prosecuting a video company called Extreme Associates? And Dr. Block's response to that is at her website, drsusanblock.com, What's New Editorials, Terror Journals, and then her article, Extreme Ashcraft, in the Terror Journals. You can see the Reverend's response to that by clicking on a link in the right margin column, Patriot Letters. Remember September 11th, The Bonobo Way of Peace Through Pleasure by Dr. Susan Block at Block Bonobo Foundation, Block, B-O-N-O-B-O, blockbonobofoundation.org. And, of course, click on shows upcoming to see her future live guests, shows past to see past guests, the Reverend as a live guest on Dr. Block's show, November 2002. All right. No more talking and no more plugs for now. Let's play music. Let's play a song for the people who are left out of all of the America United and Leave No One Behind and We're All in This Together, another kind of Disney-esque rhetoric. This is going to go out to the homeless. This is by Living Color from the Vivid album. This is called Open Letter to a Landlord.
Now you can tear a building down, but you can't erase a memory. These houses
Jello Biafra, and I've heard the good news. Reverend Bookburn is on. The Reverend is in at RadioVolta.org and InfidelGuy.com.
Mr. Speaker, members of Congress, and fellow citizens.
Who the hell's going to be in charge? A handful of global greed heads, or we the people? That's what it comes down to. This is the age-old question of the Democratic struggle. And not only have we come here to church tonight to ask that question, we've come here to answer that question. We the people are the sovereigns, not the corporations. And that has got to be asserted in every struggle that we're involved in. Are we just to lobby and plead in Washington for some new program, some new law, some regulation? I don't know.
War, just for fun. They are treating people.
They get high from it. About you, I'm tired of in Washington. What's possible is what the people say is possible. And that's got to come from the grassroots to the centers of power. Not from the centers of power, back to us. Patti Smith in that great rockin' song put it well. She said, people have the power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. And that's exactly the fight that we're involved in. No matter what particular issue you're in, that's the fight we're involved in. Who the hell is going to be in charge? We the people or the global greed heads? Our challenge is to go forth among and with the people to build a new grassroots, little d democratic movement so people can take power back. Take power back from the greed heads and bone heads, the speculators and spoilers, the bankers and bosses, the big shots and the bastards that are running roughshod over all of us. That's what it gets down to. I can tell you from my political travels and radio work that I've done, being in the media and et cetera, the people are ready for this. Look at it here tonight. The pews are full. We got the balcony full. People are ready. They're eager. And this is happening all across America. The great thing about America is Americans. Don't buy the establishment line that tries to hold you in your place, that people only care about themselves. All they want is money. People are comfortable. They don't want to rock the boat. Well, we're a people, I think, who have within our hearts and very souls the deep values of democracy, the founding values of this country. What are those? I think it comes down to at least three things. Economic fairness. We believe in that. Social justice, that's in our hearts, every American. Equal opportunity for all people, we stand for that. That's what our fight is about. It's not about another nickel a bushel on wheat. or nickel a pound on milk. It's not about another dollar an hour on the wage, not another regulation we can get from the city council. It is about fairness, justice, equal opportunity. And we've got to go to the people with those values, because that's what they have in their hearts, and that's what we're fighting for. Sadly, exception of Wellstone, a few others, got too few politicians even willing to talk about these values anymore, much less attempt to implement any of them. Of course, I think our problem is we've got too many 5-watt bulbs sitting in 100-watt sockets. You know what I mean? And as a result of their dimness, we've got a darkness descending across our land. No longer is American leadership in Washington, on Wall Street, in our state capitals, pursuing the common good. Now, this is the ethic. This is the glue that holds us together as a nation, as a society. The notion that we're all in this together. My old daddy, beware of Texans telling daddy stories, but I had a pretty good one. My old daddy used to express his political philosophy to me. He didn't know he had a political philosophy, by the way. He would be embarrassed to have been told he did have one. But my old daddy supported this notion of the common good. He wanted a public library to be built in my little town of Denison, Texas, back in the mid-1950s. Not because he ever went in the library. That's not what he did. I never saw him go in it. But it's because he believed it was for the common good of the community, and he wanted to be taxed, among others, and he helped to organize a fight to get a public library in there. Nothing particularly stout about that. All I'm saying is people are like that all across America. People are willing to stand up for the common good if it is appealed to them to do that. And my old daddy used to say to me years ago, Jim, he said, everybody does better when everybody does better. That's what passes for political philosophy in Denison, Texas. Well, now, the privileged few have decided to discard that ethic of the common good, to separate themselves from the rest of us. Affordable housing? Who needs it? We've got gated and guarded luxury compounds where we live. Public schools? We've got private academies. We're going to get vouchers to finance it. Public transportation? Hey, we got Lexus lanes down the interstate. We don't need that. Even the public stadiums, now tax-paid arenas with luxury skyboxes to separate the precious few so that they don't have to breathe the air of the riffraff who are down in the stands. They're imposing a new pernicious ethic of greed on our society, an ethic that says, I got mine, you get yours. Never give a sucker an even break, caveat emptor, I'm rich and you're not. Adios, chump, that's pretty much what they're saying to us. Well, they're getting richer and they're getting more powerful at our expense. Now, of course, they're getting theirs the old-fashioned way. They're getting the government to give it to them. Remember that old song that Woody Guthrie sang about outlaws during the last Depression? Pretty Boy Floyd the Outlaw. The verse in it said, as through this world I travel, I see lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six-gun, and some with a fountain pen. It's the fountain pens who are doing the serious stealing in our society today. Now, here comes the commander in thief, George W. Bush. Shrub, as we call him in Texas, because he doesn't even measure up as tall as a bush. I can tell you in Texas that as governor, he was an absolute corporate wet dream. Any fantasy that a corporate executive had could come true by making campaign donations to George W. Bush. Now he's open for business in the White House. In my newsletter, the Hightower Lowdown, latest issue, I think you've had copies passed out to you, latest issue called Bush Incorporated, Open for Business. And I do a little rundown of all 16 cabinet members where they talk about how diverse these people are. Oh, my goodness, the diversity is just astonishing. We've got four women, a Cuban-American, a couple of African-Americans, a Japanese-American, a Lebanese-American, and, wait a minute, even a Democrat is in there. Lord have mercy, there's no end to the diversity until you begin to look at their pedigree and where they come from. What we have here is corporate America writ large in the cabinet. We have four CEOs of corporations. We have two lobbyists for corporations. We have several of them directors of corporations. That's who's represented. And it's detailed in here who they are and what kind of a government we can expect as a result. And it's already begun. But beneath the little charades of let's go down and make nice with the new Mexican president and let's, you know, let's end the divisiveness in Washington and all those sort of slogans of the day and the themes of the week, he's already quietly begun to slip it all in. Here comes something called the Free Trade of Americas. Have we heard about this? The FTAA. It's the extension of NAFTA from Canada all the way down through the tip of South America. We've got a saying in Texas, if you find that you've dug yourself into a hole, the very first thing to do is quit digging. But here we go. We're in a hole with NAFTA, and now we're going to extend it to everybody else. Not to the people, of course, to the elites in those countries. Here he comes with his tax cut program. Says, well, everybody's going to get a seven-course dinner. Everybody's going to benefit. Leave no one behind. Seven-course dinner for all. Well, indeed, the wealthiest will have a feast. Rest of us, possum in a six-pack. That's what we can expect in the way of a seven-course dinner. Now here he comes with Star Wars. Next issue of my newsletter, going to talk about that for you. He's already pledged to push that through. Donald Rumsfeld, big fart, secretary of dispensing the booty to major military contractors, is pushing that very, very hard. And they're not just pushing Bill Clinton's Star Wars program, the Yugo version of Star Wars, which will only cost $60 billion. Instead, they're pushing the Cadillac version, which will cost $240 billion for something that doesn't work and is not needed. Don't we have something else we could spend $240 billion on? Like small crack classrooms, K through 12? Like health care for every American? Couldn't we spend $240 billion better? Well, the issue, of course, is not what Bush will do. He'll do whatever rich son of a Bush has done before him. And that is to serve the corporate interests. Fine, the rich need representation. I have no objection to that. The question is, what do we do? Powers that be on Wall Street, in Washington, in the media, now are trying to use September 11th as an opportunity to shut off debate and dissent, to close down any progressive agenda here at home or abroad. Worse than what the powers that be are trying to do is that some of our own, some of our national progressive organization instruct us to be quiet in this period of patriotism. Hush up, they say. Duck down. Don't push. Hide. Don't criticize George W. because we can't seem to be in any way unpatriotic. If the meek ever inherit the earth, these people are going to be land barons, don't you think? Be quiet? We have no right to be quiet. Legions of democracy fighters who went before you and me, struggled and suffered, bled and died to bring us this far along in our democratic journey, to make our struggles today even possible. Democracy's not a given. We have no right to be quiet. Patriotic? Patriotism doesn't mean being stupid. Notice that. Notice that corporate lobbyists are not quiet. They're shouting patriotism at the top of their lungs while they unscrew the Capitol Dome in Washington, D.C. and reach in with both hands to loot the public treasury. That's not patriotism, it's plundering. Here's their patriotism for you. You know, the very first piece of legislation that Congress passed following September 11th, 2 days after September 11th, first piece of legislation went through. was to add $8.3 billion for Star Wars. Provide a missile defense system. We needed a box cutter defense system, don't you think? Missile defense system? Here's patriotism for you. Yesterday, the House of Representatives passed fast-track legislation. Choo-choo-choo-boogie, here it comes. Railroading more globaloney down our throats, like NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. Now to bring us NAFTA on steroids, the free trade area of the Americas, taking NAFTA from the Arctic to the Antarctic. In a rigged vote, barely passed it, 214 to 215, one vote margin yesterday. They didn't just twist it arms. They ripped arms out of their sockets and whacked people over the heads with them in the Congress. In fact, they had to cheat. We won the vote. It came down to the final time. You get a certain period of time to vote in the House of Representatives, at the end of which the clock ticks to zero. The clock ticked to zero. But Speaker Hastert would not gavel the vote done, even though it was done. And they surrounded two Republicans on the floor of the House of Representatives and finally got one of them to come forward and to change his vote. And that's how we got fast-tracked. Then they come forward and say, in the name of patriotism, we must pass a capital gains tax break. A tax break that 80% of which will go to the wealthiest 2% of Americans. Then they come forward with a stimulus package to get our economy restarted. It includes a give back of $25 billion in corporate tax payments to General Electric, General Motors, Ford, IBM, and the likes of that. They're saying to these corporations, not only do you no longer have to pay any taxes whatsoever, but we're going to give back all the taxes you have paid in the last 15 years. Where do you get to sign up for that? Huh? Where can I sign up to get my taxes back for the last 15 years that I have paid? But $25 billion is being lifted out of the federal budget. $25 billion we could use in these hard times. Being lifted out of the federal budget and given to a handful of corporate greed heads. The only thing this stimulus package is going to stimulate is more campaign contributions to the Republicans who ran this one down our throat. You want patriotism? Here comes the airline industry following September 11th, asking for a $15 billion bailout for management and the big investors, including a specific provision of pay protection for the CEOs. Yes, there's a provision in that act that says that the exorbitant pay packages of the CEOs of the airlines cannot be tampered with. At the same time, they excluded any severance package for the workers, 100,000 of which had been laid off directly out of the airline industry, not counting those who are tangential to that industry. And then the bosses canceled the 2 week severance pay that was due under the union contracts for the union workers. The spokesperson for American Airlines said, well, we need to withhold severance in order to continue operating. American Airlines off 20,000 workers. Now, what about the families? How are they going to continue operating under this provision? I'll just make an observation to you. I attach no moral judgment to this at all. Boss, spelled backward, is double S-O-B. It's just a fact. Also notice that these are anti-big government CEOs, right? For years they've been saying, we got to get government out of our backs. Well, when they got their butts in a crack, who did they turn to? I believe it was big government, wasn't it? But they only want big government for them, not for you. Even a dog knows the difference between being stumbled over and being kicked. We're being kicked. And if that's not enough phony patriotism for you, here comes autocratic John Ashcroft at us, an absolute ideological crackpot who's shredding our constitutional freedoms in the name of defending freedom. Yesterday, in the U.S. Capitol, he testified, and he said that anybody who criticizes the administration is giving aid to terrorists and, quote, providing ammunition to America's enemies. This is a guy Joe McCarthy would want to hug. But I got to tell you what, They can wrap themselves in a flag, but it's kind of like putting earrings on a hog. It just doesn't hide the ugliness that's down under all of this stuff. And I got to tell you something else. That flag does not belong to them. It's our flag. It belongs to us. That flag symbolizes our democracy, our freedom of speech, our civil liberties, our right to privacy, our right to dissent, our right to be agitators. I'm flying a flag on my little 1997 made in the USA Ford Escort around South Austin like some Thomas Paine in Bubba Land there, and I'll be double damned to hell before I surrender that flag to the xenophobes and warmongers and profiteers and autocrats and political weasels and other abject opportunists who want to steal our flag out from under us. The people of America are revolting, in the very best sense of that term. America's media and political leaders also are revolting, but in the very ugliest sense of that term, for they mostly are ignoring the people's revolt. All across our great country, there's a massive outpouring of heartfelt, outraged opposition to George W.'s Iraq attack. Tens of thousands of people have joined street rallies, candlelight vigils, marches on congressional offices, protests at Bush's fundraisers, visits to Dick Cheney's house, and other demonstrations, not only in D.C., San Francisco, and other expected places, but also in places like Tulsa and New Smyrna, Phoenix and Dearborn, Roswell and Rochester. This rebellion includes grandmothers who've never protested, Gulf War and Vietnam vets, church folks, corporate executives, even Republicans. In addition to street actions, Congress is deluged with letters, email, faxes, and phone calls against the pell-mell rush into Iraq. Robert Byrd, the usually hawkish senator from West Virginia who led the opposition to Bush's war resolution, says he got 20,000 calls and 50,000 emails in 1 week urging him to keep up the fight. Quote, "They are my heroes," he said, of these grassroots rebels, adding that the American people seem to have a better understanding of the Constitution than those who are elected to represent them. Yet, if you watch television news and listen to the pundits, you'd think you're alone in America if you don't go along with Bush's BS. The mass media establishment has been a perpetual war drum, mostly ignoring the spreading prairie fire of opposition. But have heart, we're stronger than you think. Even in Congress, 23 senators and 133 House members voted no on the war resolution, including 90% of African American members, 80% of Latinos, 60% of House Democrats, and 59% of the women in Congress. This is Jim Hightower saying, now that's a solid base for sanity, and we've only begun to fight, so keep agitating. I'm waving the flag these days. The Stars and Stripes, oh glory, our flag. Since September 11th, I've been waving it all over the place because it stands for something special, historic, important, and uniting. I'm not waving it as some macho bravado assertion of American empire, but in the spirit of America Eternal, the land of deep democratic values and ambitions, the place where liberty and justice for all is not just a throwaway line, but a founding principle that we must struggle daily to try to implement. Our flag is more than an emblem of America's financial and military might. It's a mirror in which we can see reflected our finest ideals of economic fairness, social justice, and equal opportunity. Or not. This is why it's especially important for us to wave America's flag now, in these dark days when anti-democratic forces are loose in Washington and in the media, howling for a repression of the very freedoms the flag symbolizes. I'll be double-damned to hell before I meekly allow this banner of democracy to be usurped by political opportunists, corporatists, xenophobes, warmongers, and fearmongers who confuse conformity with patriotism, demanding that we be quiet, get in line, and be patriotically correct. Hey, we're not lemmings. We're citizens. And, as the founders knew, the first job of a citizen is to keep your mouth open. Our democracy was forged in rebellion, crafted by mavericks and risk-takers who refused to salute authority. They rejected all autocrats who tried to suppress liberties in the name of providing security and order. This is Jim Hightower saying, ours is the flag of the pamphleteers and sons of liberty, the abolitionists and suffragists, populists and wobblies, Mother Jones and Joe Hill, Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King Jr., freedom fighters all. Too many patriots struggled and died to bring our democracy this far. We have no right to be quiet. Stand up, wave our flag, speak out.
You're living in other people's lives. Doesn't seem to be doing you a lot of use. Believing in other people's lies is getting pretty hard to tell the truth.
That was the Adverts doing Cast of Thousands from Jim Hightower's CD, The People Are Revolting, in the very best sense of the word. From AlternativeTentacles.com, you heard Who the Hell is in Charge, We Have No Right to Be Quiet, The Rebellion, and Wave Our Flag. Living Color did Open Letter to a Landlord. This is Reverend Bookburn. The show is called The Reverend Is In. Tonight's theme is September 11th, 2 years later, Nation Still Clueless. And I cut out a whole lot of music and content. And I'm going to do a quick closing because we're losing the AN listeners. Every other stream will go a little overtime, and we're going to hear Hopeless Dregs of Humanity in the overtime part. But while we still have AN folks, I want to play a Johnny Cash song, Who Died One Day This Week, a couple days ago, and we will play him a song. Next week is Cooking with Paul Hill, and you can write to me, Rev Bookburn, care of Quayle, Quayle, Quayle at sjcdc.org, and be placed on the mailing list if you so choose. The Cheryl Miller Memorial Project is at cherylmemorial.org. emergency contraception information known as ECP at backupyourbirthcontrol.com. Bill Baird and Joni Scott from the Pro-Choice League at ProChoiceLeague.com, the Reverend's Friends, Dark Lady at DarkLady.com, and Ms. Terry at RadioLeft.com. Hopeless Dregs of Humanity from EverReviledRecords.com, and Renee Bryant's band All or Nothing HC from OnTheRag.net. The Reverend would like to thank the following for assistance, information, humor, or just general inspiration for tonight's show, too. Kenny, Amoeba, Lord Jesus, Marlon the Great Engineer, Sister Kathy and her party guests, Plantard from England, the European Book Burners, who listen to this show in the middle of the night, Hippie John, Heidi Helper, the Coffee Goddesses, Mother Therese, Deicide, Hopeless Dregs of Humanity, Renee Bryant, Paul Kresner, all of Radio Volta for enduring the looting and theft of a radio transmitter by Satan's sexual partner, and community leader, Sister Bay, the two Washington independent radio stations that aired the show, Dr. Susan Block, Melanie from the Dr. Susan Block Show and Elegant Angel Video Productions, Dark Lady and her new honey, Jennifer Hunter, from JenniferHunterConsulting.com, Ms. Terry, all clinic defenders, and Dallas Blanchard. Okay, let's start the song. While we are saying goodbye to the AN listeners, every other stream, expect a little bit of overtime. This is the late Johnny Cash doing A Boy Named Sue. Lord, make this play.
Well, my daddy left home when I was 3 and he didn't leave.
This is the Atheist Radio Network.